Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Ferguson. I'm Professor of Divinity and a member of the Gifford Committee. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to this, the sixth and final lecture in Professor Michael Vilker's 2019 Gifford Lectures in God's Image Anthropology. This lecture will be recorded online as usual, and the Gifford blog will continue over the coming days, so there remains an opportunity to post a comment on the lecture series if you feel so moved. Our format this evening is a little different. We're concluding, I'm pleased to say, with a drinks reception, which is being set up even as I speak. And what I would propose is that we have a short vote of thanks to Professor Vilker at the end of the lecture. This will be an opportunity to express our appreciation. After which, instead of the usual Q&A session, we will move to the drinks reception, and there you'll have an opportunity to speak with Professor and Frau Vilker more informally. So if you have further questions, pose them to Professor Vilker over a glass of wine at the end this evening. Tonight's lecture is entitled Called to Peace, and is the final in this series that we've been greatly enjoying. So please, would you welcome to the podium for the last time, Professor Michael Vilker.
Thank you very much, David. Called to peace. Many people understand peace to mean primarily the absence of war. Yet although almost all people fear war, opinions on how best to attain and secure peace can vary widely. In the spring of 2019, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, published depressing statistics, demonstrating that a disturbingly intense arms race is currently underway throughout the world. Indeed, it has been 30 years since arms expenditures were at this level. In the past 10 years, China has increased its arms expenditures tenfold. While during the year 2019 alone, the USA increased its arms expenditures by $50 billion, simultaneously cutting funds for development cooperation by almost the same amount. The conservative minister for economic aid in the Federal Republic of Germany, Gerd Müller, recently lamented that, I quote him, "If we could redirect even a quarter of military expenditures toward developmental cooperation, we could put a stop to hunger, death, that is death caused by severe conditions of distress and disaster, and poverty, as well as to the miseries of refugees worldwide. We must stop this disastrous cycle. Worldwide, about $1,600 billion go to the military. Only $160 billion to development. Someday we will pay a high price for this disproportion." I start with my first part of the lecture on eternal peace, Kant versus Vegetius. It was the military theoretician Vegetius, late 4th century, who coined the motto embraced by many states at the time and which many states still embrace, namely, si vis pacem para bellum, if you want peace, prepare for war. The great philosopher Immanuel Kant vehemently objected to this position in his famous publication, Eternal Peace, the most successful publication of Kant's, in which he argued that this view merely equates peace with ceasefire. At the time, however, Kant was certainly no rigid pacifist. At the same time, he was not a rigid pacifist. He saw quite clearly that states need a border defense and must be in a position to oppose attacks from without. He does, however, challenge the notion that this goal can be attained solely by means of maximum armament, a perpetually expanding production of heavy weaponry, and the concomitant development and expansion of organized military power. Kant's key idea is that only conceptual and political efforts subordinated to the idea and praxis of the rule of law and justice can promote peace. The German philosopher Ottfried Höffe has formulated this notion with elegant succinctness. Kant opposes the essential thrust of Vegetius' motto, civis pacem para bellum, if you want peace, prepare for war, with the assertion, civis pacem para justitiam, if you want peace, ensure justice. Not the power of violence and weapons, but rather only the power of justice and politics that supports justice through subordination to it can secure the kind of peace that fundamentally excludes war by genuinely constituting the end of all hostilities, merits being called eternal, according to Kant. Kant's essay, which takes the form of a contract, deals quite soberly with the doubts and questions concerning whether this concept is realistic in the first place and whether real politics genuinely can be subordinated in practice to the idea of justice. Kant presents an ethical, moral, political, and legal process of inculcation in which the multimodal spirit of peace can unfold. To it, people themselves, both the governed and the governing, friend and foe, are to be persuaded that this world can live without belligerent actions and the infinite misery and suffering that follows in their wake. They can live without these dangers if all people commit to live with one another under the rule of an ethically, morally shaped notion of justice. Broad stretches of this document seem to be spoken directly to our time, rather than composed over 200 years ago. Precisely by illuminating the intellectual, moral, material, natural, political, legal, and not at least also the economic and medial framework necessary for politics and ethos of peace, Kant's essay acquires an enduring, undiminished power of persuasion. On the basis of the following insights, Kant himself can be reckoned as a conceptual precursor of the Charta of the United Nations of October 24, 1945, especially in the preamble and the Articles 1 and 2. It is as they have read Kant's important treatise on peace and then said, okay, we will put it as a kind of post-war documentation to secure a peaceful living together of the United Nations. So, first, the old idea of statesmanship was oriented toward perpetually expanding the power and territory of the state and was commensurately designed for expansion and aggression. Politics was satisfied with merely a truce that was called peace, but that in principle made it possible to further state interests in expansion and aggression. Kant appeals to the dignity of rulers and to the true honor of the state to desist fundamentally and enduringly from this attitude. Second, if you want peace, then appreciate and foster your own freedom and that of others. Any politics of peace must respect the sovereignty of states and the freedom of their citizens. Military cooperation between states and the mustering of citizens for defense come about only when states agree in a specific case to the self-defense of a given state against external aggression. Any politics of peace must also take measures to put to a stop to economically exploitative relationships between states and to all forms of violent intrusion and terrorist activity. And third, with respect to organized military entities, the commitment to a rigorous politics of peace requires in the long run the gradual elimination of standing armies and the gradual dismantling of competitive expansions of armaments between states. For our age, too, these demands remain an enormous, challenging task for all humankind. Comparable to the struggle for egalitarian justice and freedom, and against ecological brutality and global climate destruction. The hope for conversion of armament industries from their primary production of destructive weaponry into politically and ecologically creative technological instruments of peace requires that we all take a deep breath of patience. Nonetheless, precisely this transition should be initiated on an international basis and with appropriate efficiency control. Nor should the acknowledgement be delayed that the best long-term way to secure borders and ensure the peaceful organization of states and the increasingly multinational and multi-ethnic composition of their populations is not through walls and destructive weaponry, but solely through creative external developmental assistance alongside responsible domestic policies of education and integration. As Kant himself emphasizes, the prerequisite for actualizing this vision is the implementation of legal and constitutional measures that guarantee the freedom and equality of all citizens, secure respect for justice and the law, and stabilize the division of political power between the executive and the legislative branches of government. International goals include the establishment of a federal alliance of states and the development of international law to be complemented by the propagation of human rights. See, many, many visions that partly we have followed. The indispensable foundation of the national and international order of peace is the development of the appropriate legal and moral thinking and the concomitant understanding of politics, along with, as Kant puts it, publicity, which we today associate with the power of education, science, scholarship, and the media, and of which the transparency of action constitutes an essential part. Kant says, all actions relating to the rights of other men are unjust if the maxims on which they are based are not compatible with publicity. If you want peace, then promote respect for the truth and a commitment to communication that seeks the truth. This requirement is inherent in Kant's demand that action relating to the rights of others be compatible with publicity. If you want peace, then appreciate and promote your own freedom and that of others. Respect the sovereignty of other states and the dignity of the citizens. If you want peace, then ensure justice. Our topics. The extent to which the multimodal spirit of peace is interwoven in a variety of ways with the multimodal spirit of justice, freedom, and truth becomes quite clear in these considerations. Yet the political, legal, and moral framework for any enduring thwarting of belligerent activities and for supporting the urgently needed efforts to prompt the concrete transition of the armaments industry currently focused on a maximum destructive capacity, to a political framework focused on peace, constitute but one aspect of the multimodal spirit of peace. For how are people to be persuaded to withdraw their loyalty from the politics of a spiraling arms race? How exactly can one ignite a passionate interest in them for eternal peace? What sources might nourish such commitment and courage for eternal peace? Yeah, this was the Charter of the United Nations, and now peace as an internally human and civilizational disposition. In his book, Adventures of Ideas, Alfred North Whitehead asked about the essential qualities whose joint realization in social life constitutes civilization. In his opinion, these qualities are truth, beauty, adventure, art. He asked further how the pursuit of these qualities might be kept from becoming ruthless, hard, and cruel. The solution, in his view, is to be found in a harmony of harmonies, which shall bind together the other four qualities, truth, beauty, adventure, and art, so as to exclude from our notion of civilization the restless egotism with which they have often, in fact, been pursued. I choose, he says, the term peace for that harmony of harmonies, which calms destructive turbulence and completes civilization. Whitehead defines the spirit of peace as a broadening of feeling that generates a remarkable loss of self and an equally remarkable expansion of self, of the person or of the entity, the institution that focuses on peace. Peace, he says, results in a wider sweep of conscious interest. It enlarges the field of attention. It focuses on coordinations, concurrences between human beings that are wider than personality or than any single initiative for peace from whatever source, expansion of views. But it discerns quite clearly the self-enlargement that individual persons and social entities risk who want nothing more than to continue with proven structures of self-preservation and self-development, and who as a result end up losing, gradually, in a creeping fashion, the capacity to be surprised and the intensity of feeling and emotion. The depth and breadth of this their capacity for experience diminish. They themselves atrophy, be it at ever so lofty a level. Their world steadily shrinks and becomes steadily more impoverished and insignificant. So I said, if you just want to continue your identity, then you will face a shrinking world. Then you will not understand new developments, you will not develop, but you will be aware of lesser and lesser opportunities. But it counters this notion by proposing peace as the intuition of permanence, a condition fulfilled only by conditions of the soul and the world that are, he says, an abiding perfection, enter into the nature of things, a treasure for all ages. Although this vision of peace is a creative process that transcends primary interests in simple self-relationships and self-preservation, may seem rather vague and effusive, it does nonetheless offer a perspective from which to discern insufficient and inadequate notions of peace. Such notions variously mistake peace, for example, for tranquility, order, security. For after all, even those who perpetrate extraordinary repressive or even terrorist circumstances can boost about regnance of order, security within their own spheres of influence. For example, the assertion that under apartheid, the streets of Cape Town were quiet during the evening, and one could, of course, hear similar assertions in Germany under Hitler. In book 19 of De Civitate Dei, Augustine presents a lofty doctrine of peace focused on the idea of a social order that ensures calm and justice. Although Augustine can also understand peace as the absence of strife, and as undisturbed calm, such undisturbed order can just as easily derive from the cemetery calm of repression. Augustine is intent on articulating the idea of peace at a deeper level, probably picking up initiatives from Cicero and the Stoics. He associates peace with undisturbed order in which justice reigns. Rüdiger Bittner, German philosopher, I introduced him to you several times, maintains that Augustine here adopts the Stoic view that order as objective justice constitutes a fundamental characteristic of the world. Augustine then externally refers this empirically sooner unpersuasive view to God as the governor of this order. But this view in its own turn merely obscures the difficulties accompanying any linking of a sustainable understanding of peace with a persuasive program for the realization of justice. The difficulties we encountered in the third lecture with the now dull instrument of natural law catch up with Augustine here. An inherent but unrealistic just order is attributed to the world and nature with God as its guarantor and with sweet peace ultimately being displaced into a heavenly beyond. And so here you see one of the instances where my reserves against problematic concepts of transcendence come up. So you see, I like Augustine. He is one of my favorite theologians, absolutely. But here you see a collapsing great concept. Yeah, so it doesn't work really in observable reality. It doesn't work for justice. And it's also theologically getting God under trouble, so to speak. But without the powers of the Spirit, neither nature nor the world provides any reliable foundations for peace and justice. And without the powers of the Spirit, so also do the powers of God remain mysterious and obscure. How then are such powers of the Spirit of peace to be comprehended in a sufficiently realistic fashion for an individual person? Vital refers not only to the harmonies residing in truth, beauty, adventure, and art, but also explicitly to an element considerably more accessible to human experience and to the individual's capacity for exerting formative influence than are the largely aesthetic forms associated with the harmonies. To wit, he associates the movement of self-transcending in the direction of experiential peace with the experience of giving and receiving love. Especially as the latter are associated with intimate and caring parental love. This love is above all love that serves the carefree development of the beloved counterpart. But it itself refers to the love of self-devotion, where the potentialities of the loved counterpart are felt passionately as a claim that it finds itself in a friendly universe. I love this quote, so I give it again. Love, it's the love of self-devotion, where the potentialities of the loved counterpart are felt passionately as a claim that it finds itself in a friendly universe. This insight does indeed open a vision of a more profound experience of peace. I come to my third part. Okay. Benevolence toward humankind and shared joy on true inner peace. This sort of solicitous, caring love that wants only the best for the beloved and that seeks but to contribute in a considered and far-sighted fashion to that person's free development, such that it find itself in a friendly universe, is a magical power. It transcends far more than merely one's own natural interest in self-preservation. For by seeking to serve the free self-development of the beloved, it also overcomes, to whatever extent possible, its own natural tendencies for control and imposition. This inclination runs quite counter to our tendencies toward natural, unavoidable self-preservation, as well to tendencies for loving care in continuity solely with our own self-preservation. I've come to refer to this inclination as free, creative self-limitation and self-withdrawal on behalf of others. Free and creative self-limitation and self-withdrawal on behalf of others. This expression refers to a radical movement of self-transcendence that cannot really be grasped through the simple notion of selflessness. The reference is instead to a vital energy and a life beyond the usual understanding of natural vital energy, which is inherently and indispensably linked to self-continuation and self-preservation. Through giving and receiving this love, a person acquires, even in this life, a portion of the eternal life that points beyond natural earthly life circumstances. So in natural earthly life, we have to preserve ourselves. In love, in this kind and caring love, we creatively withdraw in favor of the beloved others, and so we live already a life beyond the earthly parameters and measures of life. It's a part of eternal life in all its modesty. This love responds to the question Martha Nussbaum formulated in Upheavals of Thought as follows. She writes, how then can love reform itself so as not to be exclusively needy, vengeful, or partial, and so as to be supportive of general social compassion, reciprocity, and respect for individuality? In an assessment, large assessment, on the works of numerous thinkers, poets, and even a composer, Nussbaum seeks answers to this question concerning appropriate essence of love, albeit without finding clear, comprehensive answers. Studies by Martin Novak and other evolutionary theoreticians have shown that not only mutation and selection, but also cooperation plays a key role in success within evolutionary history. Indeed, cooperation takes place even at a cellular level. Where such cooperation collapses and cells revert to their primitive program of selfish replication, destructive and deadly processes begin. Novak writes, cancer is a breakdown of cooperation. Evolutionary success through cooperation is characterized by reciprocal processes accompanied by, as a rule, calculated assessments of cost and usefulness, though also by sooner unquantifiable enhancements to the reputation of individuals and groups. And Novak observes that the recent appreciation of the importance of evolution of cooperation shifts the perspective of evolution from a purely competitive scenario to one that includes the possibility of cooperation and altruism. More than this, one can argue that cooperation is needed for constructing higher levels of organization in the biological world. Gigantic claim. Sarah Coakley picked up these initiatives in her 2012 Gifford Lectures in Aberdeen with the title Sacrifice Regained, Evolution, Cooperation, and God. In her sixth lecture, Reconsidering Natural Theology, Meaning, Sacrifice, and God, she advocates the notion of altruism beyond calculation, which she considers motivated ultimately by Christology and a theology of the cross. She engages images of the resurrection to evoke what she calls a positive and effective commitment based on religious and aesthetic powers. The question now is how one can accommodate these scientific and religious concerns to universal and, in this sense, natural human experiences and to an ascertainable sense of inner peace. Coakley has maintained that every pregnancy and every birth is associated with created self-withdrawal on behalf of new life and to that extent also with the notion of sacrifice. An illuminating study by Sigrid Brandt has opened our eyes to the fact that because some languages, German, Russian, and other, do not distinguish between sacrifice and victim, they ineluctably suggest the notion of inevitable victimization within sacrifice. And I think the association with the theology of the cross immediately, for many people, then bring in the victimization of Christ to the front. This circumstance has prompted a great many highly problematical and erroneous theological and ideological developments. Yet even though some births do indeed result in life-threatening situations or even in death, the sacrifice of pregnancy and birth should not for that reason necessarily be associated with victimization. In intact natural and political life circumstances, the resulting new life enriches the mother, the family, and the world, and in this sense, the attempts of Brandt and Coakley to encourage liberating discourse about sacrifice. Especially Brandt's arguments for a deeper understanding of sacrifice without victimization are of inestimable value. Because references to sacrifice and even love often exhibit dramatic and out-of-the-ordinary connotations, they can be associated with peace only to a limited extent. Distinguishing between hot, warm, cool, and cold emotions can help impose order on the world of feelings. Cold emotions are generally dying or dead emotions that, in a sense, simply play themselves out. In contrast, many stronger aesthetic emotions can be called hot emotions. In popular culture, electronic transmissions through the media and elite athletic competitions, we had this in the first lecture, and of musical entertainment, electronically represented musical entertainment, represent unmistakable examples of efforts to generate hot emotions. Romantic love, in the guise of one-sided yearning or as mutually reciprocal love, is and will, as a rule, remain hot and exciting. Although the depth of devotion associated with kenotic love, that is ever willing to make sacrifices, is often quite moving, it can also take on forbidding and threatening forms. By contrast, we tend to perceive the love between partners and friends as warm, as it were, as iterations of covenantal love in which people remain loyal through thick and thin. But it's only in limited spheres of life that people can experience these various forms of love, warm love. And it is not hot, but rather only warm love of the sort we both give and experience with the intimate spheres of parental love that can be associated with inner peace. The grand magical power that turns love into a universal power of both internal and external peace resides beyond the powers of warm love, within what one might call the cool and calm love of benevolence toward humankind that wishes only good and never ill to one's fellow human beings. This love is even willing to engage both in cooperation and within limits in creative self-withdrawal on behalf of fellow creatures. It does not constantly calculate the balance of cost-usefulness. The potential for its own self-development does not represent a constant stimulus for it. Instead, it provides space for others and then is glad when it too is granted space for development and forward movement. This cool and calm love of benevolence toward humankind can, of course, intensify to more empathetic forms of love. It can become more excited, warmer, hotter. Indeed, even to the point of restricting or bringing to an end one's sense of peace. But the sense of calm, shared joy that accompanies the warm and the cool and calm forms of love invariably secures and enhances one's sense of peace. In this context, it is important that joy be acknowledged and appreciated, not only in its more overt, effusive, jubilant forms, but also in its quiet or even cool, self-forgetful manifestations. Indeed, given this broad spectrum of manifestations, one might even speak of a polyphony of joy. A project initiated by the Heidelberg Academy of Science and Humanities on the biology and opportunities associated with aging conducted interdisciplinary studies on the life experiences and feelings of people at advanced ages, including those at extremely advanced ages accompanied by dramatically increasing fragility and approaching death. Are such situations of increasingly compromised health and physical capacity necessarily characterized solely by the cold feeling of purported peace only in the sense of the peace and quiet of the cemetery? Or can one articulate a substantive understanding of peace whose resilience endures when subjected to real life experience? The observation has often been made that people in the pianissimo of advanced and extremely advanced age can become like small children. Children and young people, however, can grow in development as they should only through the care of others, the care others devote to them. In precisely this situation, they learn that the other people are here for them, people who lovingly withdraw from their own concerns on their behalf. That is, children and young people live with a life context that for those who care for them is oriented toward free creative self-withdrawal and self-limitation on their behalf. This experience of the self-withdrawal and self-limitation of others on their behalf generates, consciously or unconsciously, feelings of gratitude and affection among such children and young people. It also generates the expectation and hope that those others will continue and renew this behavior and attitude. This combination of gratitude and hope nourishes a profound sense of joy and peace that comes to expression in numerous manifestations, both emphatic and quiet. This experience of joy and peace is, of course, to be anticipated more in concentrated social circumstances that include friends and family, even if occasionally here too disappointment and alienation remain possible. But it is not only the vitality of such a social environment, but also the world of individual recollection and kinship with nature, or the rhythms of the day and year that can serve as a fertile sources of joy and a sense of peace, especially at an advanced age, which is more pronounced with its more pronounced experiences of fragility and finitude. For even amid diminishing physical and spiritual intellectual powers, gratitude and hope generate feelings of strength accompanied by joy. The phenomenon of shared joy with its accompanying sense of peace was strikingly evident in evaluations of the feelings of aging citizens in Germany. Interviews in this context disclose the preferred frameworks for dealing with what are known as themes of existence. The highest ranking framework was joy and fulfillment in an emotionally fulfilling encounter with others. Another notably preferred context was a concentration on the next generation, which, though understandably especially intensive in one's own family, nonetheless also came to strong expression in contexts for transcending that sphere. Such concentration can but must not necessarily intensify in connections with a person's capacity to contribute something to the next generation on an emotional, communicative, or material practical level. That is, the capacity to transcend one's own life burdens in creative self-withdrawal on behalf of others provides a powerful source of experiential joy and profound inner peace. This experience of peace resides securely and reliably within the warm love towards others in one's immediate sphere, as well as the cool and calm love towards others, quite beyond any ethers associated with intimate spheres. And though precisely this peaceful engagement, that same experience acquires a beneficent radiance and resonance even at the very boundaries of life's natural energies. Let me end with the conclusion. I have tried in these 6 lectures to develop a natural theology of the human and divine spirit. At the very outset, we ascertain that human finitude and frailty, and especially human seductibility and massive forms of collective self-endangerment, aggressivity and destructive inclinations, profoundly call into question any references to human beings as having been created in the image of God. The 5 subsequent lectures, then, inquired concerning what powers of the human and divine spirit might counter this discouraging state of affairs. The examination of the natural, cultural, and religious potential of the multimodal human and divine spirit presented in the 2nd lecture opened perspectives capable of bringing into focus a realistic natural theology, I hope. People filled by the multimodal spirit of justice become capable of engaging on behalf of justice in both word and deed in a world characterized by radically inequitable and unjust life circumstances. Precisely thus, such people are indeed called and shaped in the image of God. They are similarly shaped in the image of God when the multimodal spirit of freedom fills them and gives them the power to fight for liberation and freedom morally, legally, politically, and in countless educational contexts, in a world replete with personal and social manifestations of repression and the lack of freedom. People are similarly shaped in the image of God when, filled with the multimodal spirit of truth, they struggle to bring truth to bear critically and self-critically on the many levels of the search for truth. In the spirit of truth, they practice resolute advocacy and defense of convincingly argued and empirically tested truth claims. And not least, these people recognize that the inner connections between the activities of the spirit as the spirit of truth, freedom, and justice. These interrelated contexts in which the multimodal spirit is engaged come to a concentrated expression once more in its manifestation as the spirit of peace and in the shaping of human beings in the image of God within the peaceful struggle against those powers that try to promote a spirit of hostility, hatred, and warmongering. In the form of the warm love of family, friends, and those in our immediate surroundings, and in the form of a cool and calm universal benevolence toward all humankind, the spirit of peace acquires its overwhelming, radiant, and resonating power. The natural theological perspectives on the shaping of human beings in the image of God can also be articulated with respect to secular contexts. In the 3rd lecture, I reflected on the spirit of justice that activates the powers of political, legal, religious, and familial ethers, as well as numerous resources of empathy with which one might engage on behalf of justice and equality in a world characterized by radically inequitable and unjust life circumstances. In the 4th lecture, I suggested that the spirit of justice must, however, be accompanied by the multimodal spirit of freedom to facilitate the emergence of appropriate forms of personal, moral, and political existence in freedom and dignity. The 5th lecture demonstrated that the multimodal spirit of truth must ensure an informative, critical, and self-critical assessment of cultural and moral circumstances in society and provides impetus for a more expansive and penetrating understanding of human existence. Today, the 6th lecture has demonstrated that the spirit of peace relates all these impulses within an ethos focus nationally and internationally on justice, freedom, and on science, scholarship, education, and the communicative media that are resolutely committed to truth, thereby awakening and sustaining with both personal and interpersonal life a spirit of warm and cool and calm love and of the profound joy that accompanies such love. It is in this spirit of peace and in love that every individual person and all humankind are elevated to the dignity that comprehends all humanity and are genuinely equipped with the powers necessary for living commensurate with this grand destiny in the image of God.
My pleasant responsibility to offer a few concluding comments by way of appreciation to Professor Wilker. This has been a distinguished series of Gifford lectures, both in terms of form and content. As you will have gathered, Professor Wilker has invested a good deal of time and effort in preparing his material, describing this as the culmination of many years' research work. His lectures have been clearly presented and elegantly illustrated, and I know that he's taken much trouble to translate his manuscript from the original German into accessible English for us. His readiness to engage in discussion with his audiences, both here and online, has also enriched our understanding of his material, and we're grateful for the time that he has spent with us outside the lecture hall as well as inside it. I also wish to record the thanks of the Gifford Committee to members of the professional services who have facilitated the lecture series, those who have enabled the technology to work so smoothly, and Mark Newman and his team who have carried out the administration of the lectures so effectively. My thanks to you, the audience, who have again committed to a six-lecture series. We've had several excellent question and answer sessions, as well as a very good seminar yesterday at New College. You've braved wind and rain to attend these lectures, not to mention Halloween and Bonfire Night. And I should extend our appreciation also to those who have followed and commented on the series online, from the comfort of their homes or perhaps in different parts of the world. As we've heard over the past fortnight, Professor Wilker has assiduously committed to a program of interdisciplinary conversations with scientists, philosophers, economists, legal and political theorists, and indeed, as we heard tonight, with those involved in healthcare. This work sets him apart from most other theologians and enables him to work on a much broader canvas, making connections across boundaries and academic discourses. Although it's fashionable in our day to commit to cross-disciplinary research work, Professor Wilker has been doing it effectively for over 30 years and has been encouraging others to join him in this pursuit. His project this fortnight has been one that takes Lord Gifford at his word. His focus has been clearly on a natural theology that seeks to discern the movements of the divine spirit in human culture. Although these movements are always embattled and threatened, they are discernible across time and space in movements that incline towards justice, peace, freedom, and truth. This is a different approach to natural theology. Other Gifford lecturers have frequently sought to discern a transcendent source for order, contingency, religious, or moral experience. But preferring the language of spirit to that of nature, Professor Wilker has offered a more fluid, dynamic, and historically driven approach to his subject. This is encapsulated in his key concept of a multimodal spirit that generates the possibility of living and acting in the image of God. So what we have, if I've understood him aright, is a new matological, bottom-up, and historically inflected natural theology. I'm relieved to see him nodding in agreement. I doubt that this has ever been attempted by any previous Gifford lecturer, though perhaps Alfred North Whitehead comes closest, and he's been duly acknowledged in many of these lectures. Much of what Professor Welker says to us is memorable, acute, humorous, and arresting, and as his words echo in our minds, he has given us much to ponder in the time ahead. We now look forward to the publication of these lectures, which will take place in both German and English, so you can take your pick, or you can read them both. As we do look forward to this publication, we now wish him and his wife Ulrika well as they return to Heidelberg tomorrow. We thank you both for being with us, and Michael for providing us with such a rich and distinguished series of Gifford lectures. Thank you very much indeed.